From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Russia test fires a missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead after the US accuses Moscow of seeking a pretext for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We condemn the Russian Federation's act of aggression. And we have, throughout this moment, evidence of a great transformation taking place. And in that transformation, we will stand with the people of Ukraine.
President Obama releases a multi-trillion dollar budget proposal for the year 2015. And Chelsea Clinton joins the fight against Africa's illegal ivory trade.
If you care about our ecology, if you care about human rights, then you must care about what is currently the crisis facing Africa's elephants.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russia's militia reports it successfully test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile. The move came as tension continues to spike over Russian interference in the Crimea region of Ukraine. President Barack Obama says Russian interference is not a sign that Russia has scored a strategic victory over the West. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
President Obama appealed directly to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to return troops to their bases and instead choose a path to diplomacy and engage directly with the Ukrainian government. He told reporters that analysis in the media suggesting Putin had outmaneuvered the West was strategically incorrect.
Countries near Russia have deep concerns and suspicions about this kind of meddling, and if anything, it will push many countries further away.
Though in a more measured tone, President Obama backed up assertions made by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Kiev that Russia's defying international law and the norms of behavior of a major nation state.
Earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Russia is not considering annexing Crimea. But Kiev accuses Russian troops stationed in Crimea of interfering in the almost week-long standoff between the Crimean self-defense units and the main Ukrainian army. As Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow, Vladimir Putin defended the actions of Russia's army, saying they were justified.
Vladimir Putin said Russia is not going and will not go to war with Ukraine. However, he added, if he were to take such a decision, it would comply with international law, as Russia has received a request for help from the legitimate president of the country. The only thing that we did was to reinforce the security of our military facilities, which had been constantly threatened, the Russian president said. He added, while the ousted Viktor Yanukovych has no political future, he remains the officially elected head of state, and that in his absence no top-level contacts are possible between Kyiv and Moscow. Overall, he said the extreme tension of the situation in Crimea has dissipated and there is no longer need for the use of Russian armed forces there.
Meanwhile, after emergency talks in Brussels, NATO says it's intensifying its assessment of the persistently unstable security situation in Ukraine. A second NATO meeting with Russia was announced for Wednesday, where details of any actions to bolster the Ukrainian border by NATO may be announced. The United Nations Secretary General has recommended sending a 12,000-strong peacekeeping mission to the Central African Republic as ethnic violence continues. But if approved, troops could not be deployed for another 6 months. Nick Harper reports from the UN in New York.
The UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, has recommended a full peacekeeping force before, back in November. But this time, the size of his recommendation is much larger. Ban is suggesting 12,000 peacekeepers, made up of 10,000 troops and nearly 2,000 UN police. They'd help with security as well as humanitarian affairs, distributing aid and relocating the more than 1 million displaced civilians. But the scale of the task means deployment would not begin for another 6 months if the UN Security Council approves the mission.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. State Department is describing the mass stabbing which killed 29 people in China's Kunming City as an act of terrorism. It comes as Chinese state-run media heavily criticized the U.S. and Western media of double standards for not using that phrase in their response. Rebecca Hume reports from Washington.
On Monday, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki made a statement saying the attack appeared to be an act of terrorism targeting random members of the public. China's state-run news agency Xinhua was initially angered at the US embassy response in Beijing, which described the attack as a horrific, senseless act of violence. Xinhua called the U.S. reaction a double standard in the global fight against terrorism.
And the United Nations drug watchdog says the legalization of marijuana in the U.S. states of Colorado and Washington is an irresponsible move that violates international drug control conventions. The organization has a long-standing position against the legalization of recreational drugs. FSN's Mary McCarthy reports from our Colorado Bureau.
In a new report, the International Narcotics Control Board says it deeply regrets the Colorado and Washington decisions to allow any adult to buy marijuana. The UN agency says the new policies pose a threat to global efforts to combat drug abuse and is calling on the U.S. federal government to step in the states where pot is now legal.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Russia's military has test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile as international condemnation over Moscow's invasion of Ukraine continues to mount. The nuclear-capable missile was launched from a site less than 300 miles from the Ukrainian border. Prior to the test, the US Secretary of State accused Russia of looking for a pretext for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. John Kerry was in Kiev to show solidarity with the new Ukrainian government as the US unveiled plans to help the country with $1 billion in energy loan guarantees. Russia's leader Vladimir Putin had earlier denied his army had invaded Crimea, insisting Russia has the right to take military action to protect the rights of ethnic Russians. Our reporter Tom Barton is in Crimea, the focus of the Ukrainian crisis.
I stood in the pre-dawn dark recently as the ultimatum that Russia denied it had sent and Ukraine's government said it had received from Russia. Outside a military base, a Ukrainian military base near the capital, waiting as the clock ticked down towards that ultimatum. When it came at 0300 hours GMT, it passed without incident. At that particular base near the capital, Simferopol, I heard from locals that the base commander had done a deal with the Russians to try and keep the peace. There are similar standoffs across the Crimean Peninsula. There are reports that some Ukrainian troops have given up or have joined the pro-Russian Crimean authorities that Kiev does not recognise. There are reports that navy vessels of Ukraine have been blockaded into port by Russian vessels who similarly demand that they defect or give up their weapons. All of this still very much the potential for war, and all of this adding to Russia's military grip on the Crimean Peninsula.
Crimea remains the major focus of post-revolution Ukraine.
It absolutely does at the moment. The situation on the ground here is that, well, in the capital Simferopol, life does pretty much go on in the city, but there is still this increasingly aggressive amount of, some of them are dressed like Russian Cossacks, some of them are dressed in a military style. They're essentially, they call themselves self-defense battalions or militias, walking around the streets, as they have been for days now, challenging people, asking which side they're on, haranguing journalists, and generally strutting about the place, some of them wearing bulletproof vests. We've tried to ask them and some of the pro-Russian protesters what they are wearing these military-style uniforms and these protection from, at which point arguments usually break out in the crowds. Many people saying, we want peace, we are ranged against, and we do not want the fascists from Kiev, the ultra-nationalists that have taken power in Kiev, to come down and attack us here, which does not seem to be a real threat at all, as others in the crowd then say, where are these fascists? So there is divided opinion here. It is not simply as simple as saying that all Russians in Crimea, all ethnic Russians in Crimea, want to join with Russia and that the situation is just as they say. Militarily, the situation here is that essentially Russia and Russian forces now have a de facto control over most of the Crimean Peninsula. However, there are a number of Ukrainian garrisons still holding out, refusing to hand over their weapons, and that standoff appears to continue. It does seem that the chances of war that were raised with the disputed ultimatum the other day have perhaps receded, that perhaps there is now less of a chance that a shooting war will start. But still, there is always the potential that these very high passions and a lot of the old historical hatreds being brought up could lead to bloodshed.
Tom Barton in Crimea, Ukraine. Meanwhile, an emergency meeting of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, has concluded with the alliance saying its intensifying assessment of the unstable situation between Russia and Ukraine. NATO ambassadors were called by Poland under a treaty article which allows any member to convene the alliance if they feel there's a threat to territorial integrity. From the NATO headquarters in Brussels, our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock reports.
In a show of NATO unity against what its allies have perceived to be continued Russian disobedience of international law, Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said Moscow's actions continue to be seen as a threat to peace in Europe.
Russia continues to violate Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and continues to violate its international commitments. These developments present serious implications for the security and stability of the Euro-Atlantic area.
NATO has condemned Russian occupation of the southern peninsula of Crimea before, echoing similar accusations by the European Union. The EU foreign policy chief, Baroness Catherine Ashton, this week used firm language against the Russians and has been drawing up sanctions for if the situation doesn't improve.
We have condemned the clear violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity by an act of aggression of the Russian armed forces and the authorization of the use of the Russian armed forces on the territory of Ukraine. Without question, this is in breach of Russia's international obligations and its commitments.
And in a further show of NATO and EU unity, the pair will convene a rare meeting Wednesday between defence officials in Brussels, not a common occurrence due to the two sides' conflicting positions and security views on the disputes between Turkey and Cyprus. From the Ukrainian position, their interim government has made an international plea for help. These pro-EU Ukrainian protesters in Brussels say the EU has a particular duty to respond.
They should do it, indeed. And I think that bringing Russia and Ukraine together in order to solve this matter peacefully is, I think, the best way.
In order to ask European Commission, European authorities, but other countries as well, to act, not to let it go work, because it's a perfect scenario for Putin to annex new territories.
But due to the increasingly uncertain military situation on the eastern Ukrainian border, NATO is facing pressure to stand in solidarity with Ukraine, which it sees as a partner. In an effort to de-escalate tension, NATO will also be meeting with Russian officials on Wednesday. There seems to be low expectations in Brussels about how successful those talks will be. The European perspective is that the situation is currently not an improving situation. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
As Vladimir Putin maintains he has the right to mobilise his troops in Ukraine, in the name of defending the human rights of ethnic Russians, the New York Times reports that Russian activists are being bussed into the south and east of Ukraine, where pro-Russian demonstrations have ignited of late. To discuss the possibility of President Putin expanding his military presence in Ukraine, I spoke to Damon Wilson, vice president of the Atlantic Council think tank, just as his flight was about to take off, so our apologies in advance for the sound quality.
None of us are inside his head, but I think he does have a bit of a plan here, but I think it's a combination of a strategy with a tactical response based on what he feels in terms of pushback from the United States and from Europe. And that's why I think Secretary Kerry's visit is so important. I think his strategy, if you will, is really he's not going to accept his neighbors, countries of the former Soviet Union, what he considers Moscow satellites. He's not going to accept these countries moving towards the West. We used to think that just meant NATO, but he's made it clear it means the European Union as well. hence this battle over Ukraine. And I think part of what his strategy is, when he realizes that he can't control the leadership through the kleptocracy, through a pliant, dependable leader, that by seizing something like Crimea, by seizing territory as he has in Georgia, as he controls territory in Moldova, he gains leverage over these countries, and he forces them to remain dependent and in some respects dependent in Moscow's orbit. But at the same time, he also makes them very difficult partners and unattractive in some respects for NATO and the EU. What are we supposed to do as we talk about EU expansion or NATO expansion to countries that have disputes and divided territories? So I think fundamentally his strategy is to prevent the move for the West. Right now what's playing out is a question of how far he will go, how far he'll go in Ukraine. He's taken Crimea. He probed, he pushed it for a few days without having Russian fingerprints on this. When he saw that there wasn't a tremendous reaction, he went in full bore. Now I think the key point is to keep him out of eastern Ukraine by demonstrating through the response of the West that he's going to end up paying a price, because if he feels he can get away with it, his appetite may grow.
But there is something bubbling away, isn't there, in Donetsk and in Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, as you just mentioned. And there was reports in the New York Times today of what they're calling Russian tourists, essentially people who are coming in reportedly in busloads from Moscow, or on the instruction perhaps of Moscow. What sort of role are they playing there? And do we expect to see the situation in Crimea bleed into the east of Ukraine?
That depends on how the Ukrainians, the Americans, and the Europeans respond. In the absence of a response, we will see that. President Putin is probing. He's testing. It is not even very secret what he's trying to do. They have been trying to generate disturbances, protests, provocations throughout eastern Ukraine. They have sent in folks, if you will, these tourists that have come in to help sort of stir up some of these protests and these rallies. He's trying to play up the narrative that we heard so clearly in the Georgia War, trying to play up the narrative of Russian, ethnic Russians being threatened, being under duress, and therefore Mother Russia is coming to their rescue. He has already articulated a formal doctrine that Moscow has the right to intervene to protect Russian citizens abroad. In many cases, then he lays the groundwork by giving folks that speak Russian, giving them passports, making them Russian citizens. And now we see him stirring the pot. If he's able to generate enough unrest in the East, and this is fabricated, it's generated. There is no threat to an ethnic Russian population, either in Crimea or eastern Ukraine. That's ludicrous. It's a narrative that he's pushing. We had Russian troops beginning to seize facilities, walking around the streets of Crimea without Russian flags, without Russian insignia identifying them on their uniform, yet it was no secret where they came from. And that desire to be confused, that fog of war, that ambiguity leading to slow responses showed him that he could probably get away with that land grab. Now we've got to demonstrate that he can't get away with the further expansion of his aims in Ukraine.
But that further expansion can only be halted if there's an international response that Putin actually takes seriously, because asset freezes, visa bans, the suspension of military ties and wider, broader economic sanctions. Do you think they're actually going to deter Putin from his current path of military expansion into Ukraine?
You know, it's in and of themselves, none of these measures are sufficient. It's as they accumulate in the aggregate, that's the question. And so it has to be a combination of political diplomatic isolation of Russia, treating President Putin as the pariah that he is making himself into, combined with the reality of some biting economic sanctions that could be potentially twofold. One targeted at individuals and companies that have played a role in this aggression, going after their visas and going after their assets. And remember, this is a kleptocracy. Perhaps the most corrupt leader in the world.
Damon Wilson, Vice President of the Atlantic Council think tank. This is FSN Reports.
President Obama released a nearly $4 trillion budget proposal for the year 2015 today, calling for increased spending on repairing the nation's aging infrastructure and expanding access to preschool, which would be paid for by closing tax loopholes that currently benefit wealthy individuals and corporations. The president's proposal follows a report from House Republicans which called the government's anti-poverty programs a trap that makes it more difficult to find work and called for deeper cuts. On Capitol Hill, our correspondent Alice Olstein brings us the reaction from Congress to these competing visions and lays out the coming budget battle.
Speaking at a local elementary school Tuesday, President Obama said the budget he just released is designed with future generations in mind.
This opportunity agenda is built on four parts: more good jobs at good wages, making sure that we're training workers with the skills they need to get those good jobs, guaranteeing every child access to a world-class education, and making sure that our economy is one in which hard work is rewarded.
The sweeping budget proposal also makes an economic argument for passing comprehensive immigration reform, citing data from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that doing so would reduce the national deficit by almost $1 trillion over the next two decades. It also advocates for saving money by creating alternatives to detention for low-risk undocumented immigrants arrested in the United States, many of whom are currently held in expensive private prisons for months awaiting trial. But the budget also allocates hundreds of millions of dollars for immigration enforcement mechanisms criticized by immigrant rights advocates, such as adding at least 4,000 new Border Patrol agents and expanding the controversial E-Verify employer database. But much of the controversy over the president's budget proposal has been aimed at the provisions shaking up the tax code. The president said Tuesday he wants to end some benefits for the nation's richest, such as the one that lets wealthy individuals call themselves a small business to avoid paying certain taxes, and extend others to the middle class and working poor.
Right now, our tax system provides benefits to wealthy individuals who save, even after they've amassed multi-million dollar retirement accounts. By closing that loophole, we can help create jobs and grow the economy and expand opportunity without adding a dime to the deficit.
The president's budget, especially the tax provisions, quickly came under fire from Republicans on Capitol Hill, including Arkansas Senator John Bozeman.
I don't think that's the answer. We need to do the things. We need to get some certainty in the economy, make it such that people are comfortable with hiring again. That'll help more than anything.
But Bozeman did not go as far as many of his colleagues, who are demanding deep cuts to the social safety net. He said it's important to preserve funding for food aid and other programs that keep families afloat.
As I go around and to my food banks and things like that, I understand we have a serious problem. And so, you know, we just have to keep that in mind. It's so easy to look at these things and they appear to be numbers on a spreadsheet. But those lines on the spreadsheet represent families and individuals that really are in need.
This week, Republicans in the House of Representatives released a report criticizing federal anti-poverty programs like food banks, food stamps, housing subsidies, and others, claiming they're ineffective and trap people in poverty. Report author and former vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan has repeatedly called for cutting, restricting, or privatizing several major healthcare and welfare programs, and is expected to do so again in a budget coming out later this month. But many progressive members of Congress, including Michigan Democrat Sandy Levin, say Ryan's push to reduce spending on poverty would be damaging in the current economy. He said Congress's recent votes to cut food aid by billions of dollars and allow unemployment insurance to expire for 2 million people and counting are having visible effects in his home district.
I was at a pantry. It was now a month ago. I had been there 6 months before. The shelves were half empty this time. And I walked in and saw those shelves, and I said, "What happened?" And they said, "The need has been so overpowering."
As the Obama administration prepares for a budget battle over the next few months with Republicans in Congress, he may also face pushback from his own party. In today's document, he said his past proposal to cut the cost of living adjustments for seniors who depend on Social Security remains on the table. Many Democrats are staunchly opposed to that idea and have instead introduced a bill to increase Social Security payments by raising taxes on the wealthy. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And finally tonight, 2013 saw the highest ever levels for illegal ivory trading in Africa, and anti-poaching groups say not enough is being done to fight it. While supply is coming from Africa, the demand is overwhelmingly from Asia. But thousands of miles away in New York City, a panel of experts assembled to raise awareness and to discuss solutions to help protect these increasingly endangered animals. For FSN, William Densilow reports from New York.
African elephant populations are diminishing fast. Some estimates suggest that as many as 25,000 are killed by poachers every year. 2012 was statistically the worst year for elephant poaching, and in the West African nation of Gabon, it's estimated half the elephant population have been wiped out in just 10 years. Wildlife Conservation Society Vice President Joshua Ginsberg says now is the time for action.
Trends are continuing. Right? We're not winning this. Right? We're still losing elephants in Central Africa. It's expanded into East and Southern Africa. There is increased poaching in parts of Tanzania.
A department store in New York might be an unlikely location to discuss the plight of elephants, but a panel of experts assembled in Midtown Manhattan to do just that. The store's usual displays of plush furniture are packed away and replaced with rows of ivory-white temporary chairs, accommodating the few hundred or so guests. The event, called For the Love of Elephants, was moderated by former President Bill Clinton's daughter, Chelsea Clinton. She's vice chair of the Clinton Foundation, an organisation that works with NGOs and governments to tackle some of the world's biggest issues. For Chelsea Clinton, elephant poaching is a subject that both she and her foundation are desperate to tackle.
If you care about our ecology, if you care about human rights, if you care about economic development, if you care about security, then you must care about what is currently the crisis facing Africa's elephants.
For National Geographic's Director for Special Investigation, Brian Christie, who was on the panel, having Chelsea come to the event was a real boost.
Chelsea Clinton's being here was a major draw for people. But New Yorkers have always had a passion for animals.
Evidence suggests that an elephant is killed around every 15 minutes. That's nearly the same rate seen before a law introduced in 1989 that banned the international trade of ivory. Some African states are giving greater resources to law and order in order to tackle poaching, but many think this will just slow down the rate of killing. Such efforts may result in just moving poachers to other countries in Africa. For panellist Ginsberg, it's supply but also demand that needs to be focused on, and that a cultural shift is needed.
Because ivory is not unattractive, but people have to see the blood on the ivory. They have to see it and see a dead elephant. They have to see it and understand that the cost of this is devastating.
The panel argue members of the public, and importantly governments who use ivory for gifts, need to see tusks as murder, not lavish gifts. The US recently vowed to strengthen global cooperation in fighting poaching. Policies like this will certainly help, but the panel suggests it's changing cultures, not more policing, that will ultimately make a difference.
So thank you for being here this evening. We hope that this work will continue and we hope you can have success.
The panel raised many issues on elephant protection, but the overarching message is clear. If some populations and governments don't change their outlook, any conservation efforts are likely to fail. William Denslow, New York.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com, and you can always follow us on Twitter @featurestory. Coming up on Wednesday, we're in Venezuela for the latest on the country's ongoing political unrest. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.